IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. I'm Manoj Keval Ramani, and today I have with me my colleague Sunila Dixit. And we're going to be talking about the World Health Assembly. And the reason that we're going to be talking about this is that there's a second session of the WHA, which is taking place in November. There's all sorts of priorities which I want to ask Sunila about. And also, along with all of that, there's been tremendous controversy that the WHO has found itself throughout this year. We'll talk a little bit about the origins of COVID-19 and the investigation that's going on with regard to the origins. So Sunila, firstly, welcome to this conversation. And I want to begin by asking you, can you just explain to our listeners what exactly is the World Health Assembly? Is it a different body or is it part of the WHO?
Thanks, Manoj. So World Health Assembly is the decision-making body of World Health Organization. I think if for analogy, you can compare it to United Nations General Assembly, like how the United Nations has the General Assembly each year. Similarly, the World Health Organization has the World Health Assembly. So it is attended by delegations from all WHO member states. And it is annually held in Geneva, Switzerland. So the basic functions of World Health Assembly are to determine policies of WHO, appoint director general, supervise financial policies, review and approve proposed program budget. So every year in World Health Assembly, all the member states, they come together and discuss pressing issues relating to health on global level. So this is how the World Health Assembly works every year.
Does the assembly sort of, is there like a voting that happens on each of these issues, which has to be sort of majority, or is there a setup that's separate from that? Is there like a core body which takes decisions based on voting? So, for example, the UN Security Council, which takes core decisions on security, but the General Assembly has a broader vote. For example, I was reading in May when they were meeting that India was supposed to get on the board. So, is there an executive board that does this?
So, there is an executive board for this, but I guess they also look for general consensus when the resolutions are passed through the assembly.
Okay, so the executive board is important, but yes, you want general consensus. Because I remember going back to May this year, in May this year, there was a WHA meeting, which is when India was getting on the executive board. Mm. There was lots of controversy because there was talk about an investigation into the origins of COVID. There was talk about the role of Taiwan and Taiwan not being invited as an observer, because it had been in the past, but this time it was not being, it hadn't been for now a couple of years because of Xi Jinping's change of approach to Taiwan. So in that sense, that was one of the controversies that went on. So tell us a little bit about what's happened in the two rounds.
So the first round of WHO, it happened in May this year. And there was this very controversial and in terms of WHO landmark COVID-19 resolution that was passed in the May round. And this resolution that was co-sponsored by more than 130 countries was adopted by consensus. So the resolution proposed for the intensification of efforts to control the pandemic and for equitable access to and fair distribution of all essential health technologies to combat the virus. And it also called for independent and comprehensive evaluation of the global response, including WHO's response. So there was a lot of controversy at that point of time, because many member states thought that WHO's response was China-centric and that they didn't release the information in time, and that's how the pandemic spiraled out of control. So that is what the controversy was about. And I guess the evaluation has sort of started now. While the resolution was passed in May, the evaluation has started only now in November.
You know, there's a very interesting story that's come out in the New York Times about a week or so ago. It's an investigative piece which talks about, which is based on sort of internal documents and sort of interviews with a bunch of experts, really long, really detailed. It talks about that entire process of getting to this point where this resolution was passed in May and even before that. So you spoke about, you know, how people were very critical of WHO being very China-centric. Mm-hmm. And this sort of document talks about how, this report talks about how the WHO team that visited China in February, that first team that went for an investigation, how that team was allowed to go in, and that process of getting some international experts in, even under the WHO's banner, required such negotiation that when the team actually went in, the scope of its investigation was very limited. It essentially had its sort of hands tied behind the back, where it could not do so many things. It could not even question the initial response. It did not have access to adequate data. You know, even access to Wuhan itself was not allowed for a very long period of time, until the team actually started making the case that, look, if we don't even go to Wuhan, then this is an absolutely ludicrous investigation. There will be zero credibility to it. And then eventually it was the team was allowed to go to Wuhan after all of that. And Wuhan was sealed, right? So the six members of that team end up, you know, there were three Chinese and three international experts. They basically took a train to Wuhan. They stayed for about a day and visited two hospitals. They did not go to the actual market where, you know, the claim was the virus was first detected, or from where sort of the virus spread. And then they gathered together, they did their reports. And the story talks about how the Chinese members of the team would parse through every word, you know, over and over and over again, getting stuck on them so that they were, so the words were appropriate. And eventually, obviously, that report was very positive about China's response to the virus. And then again, this New York Times document reporting also goes and talks about how leading to this May investigation, this May resolution, there were, you know, there was a massive set of negotiations that went into this. And even after the adoption of the resolution, that process of starting this investigation into the zoonotic origins of the virus has been so slow. You know, as of October, people were still waiting for the Chinese to accept which international experts it would allow to enter the country. For a long period of time, the Chinese apparently said that, you know, rather than starting your investigation in China and Wuhan, why don't you start your investigation in Europe? And this they said, pointing to the fact that, you know, there are reports of COVID-19 being discovered in sewage systems in, say, Italy last year, well before any case appeared in Wuhan. And there was lots of wrangling that's gone back and forth. And just about last week, the first sort of virtual meeting of this investigation group has taken place. And the story also talks about, you know, how there are two different phases in which this investigation into COVID-19 would take place, into the origins of COVID-19. The first phase would entail a probe inside China, which would be carried out by Chinese scientists, no international observers. International colleagues will only be allowed to access the work that they do remotely. And then there would be another phase with, you know, a different set of investigation where the international experts would work with Chinese colleagues to find virus among animal hosts or any other intermediate host. So it's really interesting. There's really no clarity on how this is going to play out. It's really a long way to go. So some of the criticism of politicization, I guess, makes sense, right?
Yeah. I think everything about this investigation sounds suspicious, considering the way China is trying to keep away the international experts from actually investigating what has happened. So yeah, everything seems suspicious.
It sounds very foolhardy on their part, right? You end up creating even more suspicion when you've already got yourself in a place that, you know, when the conspiracy theories have died down, you are creating more suspicion by doing this, which is just ridiculous. Okay, so that was May, right? What's happening in November?
Yes, so in November, they have taken many decisions. And the first is they are expected to adopt a resolution to strengthen preparedness for health emergencies. And for that, the draft resolution renews the commitment to better prepare for health emergencies such as COVID-19 through full compliance with international health regulations. So international health regulations are like set of regulations which of which the purpose is to prevent, protect against, control, and provide a public health response to international spread of disease in ways which avoid unnecessary interference with international traffic and trade. So 196 countries across the globe have agreed to implement this international health regulations. And this binding instrument of international law, it entered into force in June 2007. So the resolution renews the commitment to fully comply with the international health regulations. And other than that, it urges member states to dedicate domestic investment and recurrent spending and public funding to health emergency preparedness. So basically, the resolution is asking member states to invest enough in public health facilities or develop primary healthcare services, because even if you invest in vaccine, it's not enough. You, along with vaccine, you also need to strengthen your public health system, because public health considers all social aspects of health as well. So that is what the resolution is demanding the member states.
That's interesting, right? So it's basically, it seems like there is a certain learning that's been drawn from what's happened with COVID-19. And I mean, I remember in our conversations prior to, you know, and sort of early in the pandemic, there were lots of sort of reports that had come out about countries which are extremely well prepared to deal with pandemics. Yet what we have seen, and I think the US topped that list, right?
Yes.
Yet what we've seen is that the US response has been absolutely atrocious. And there could be sort of political reasons for that in terms of how the American government under Trump sort of operated. But it also exposes a lot of weaknesses that exist in the system. So it seems like this resolution is essentially saying that, look, we are identifying some of these weaknesses and we're talking about, you know, there are some basic issues that need to be addressed, but also when you're faced with an unprecedented crisis, there are certain learnings that we've had and everybody can draw from.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, that's fascinating. Apart from this COVID-19, aspect of our, this idea of strengthening and preparedness, is there something on immunization further that they're talking about in terms of vaccines and immunization?
Yes. So actually in the May round, they came up with the immunization agenda 2030. So earlier they had this global vaccine action plan, which was supposed to run from 2011 to 2020. So now that this global action plan is coming to an end, it doesn't mean that, I mean, despite the significant progress made during the past decade, most of the global and regional immunization goals that were set out in the action plan, they will not be achieved by 2020. I mean, we are already near the end of 2020. And 1 in 5 children still lack access to all life-saving vaccines that are recommended by WHO. So what the executive board has done is requested the director general to adopt this immunization agenda 2030. And this immunization agenda is developed around 7 strategic priorities. And these strategic priorities, they are centered around aspects such as population movements, inequities, ensuring immunization for all age groups, climate change, conflict and political instability, and public health emergencies of international concern. So considering the COVID-19 outbreak, I guess we have all learned lessons that, you know, politics or population movement, they play a large role in determining how the vaccine reaches the population. So that is what the immunization agenda 2030 aims to achieve.
Okay, that's fascinating. And that's really, really interesting that they've sort of taken some of this on board. And again, in countries like India, also vaccination and access to vaccination and sort of competence in delivering vaccination to children we've done really, really well over the years in doing that, to allowing us to eradicate diseases like polio. And I think it's important that that is an agenda continue politically also for states, you know, to ensure better public health outcomes on the whole. Apart from sort of, let's move away from COVID and vaccinations in this particular aspect. 2020 was also, apart from all the politics and everything, it was also the year of the nurse and the midwife. That was sort of a theme, right? Every year there seems to be a theme at the WHO. What's the theme going forward in 2021?
So for 2021, the WHO has designated 2021 as the International Year of Health and Care Workers. And this is like even more important in times of COVID-19 pandemic. So member states and non-state actors in unison spoke for the critical role of health and care workers in ensuring our health and prosperity. So what when they designate this year as the year of health and care workers, what they mean is they will try to strengthen the capacity of healthcare workers, try to ensure that they are protected at all times, especially in times of pandemic. Also, they have called for a strong implementation of global code of practice on the international recruitment of health personnel. So this code establishes and promotes voluntary principles and practices for ethical international recruitment of health personnel and to facilitate strengthening of health systems. So the member states, they have expressed commitment to the ethical principles and practices of the code, urging prioritization of support and safeguards for the countries with greatest vulnerability, including greater investment for the healthcare workers.
Okay, that's really, really interesting that healthcare workers are being prioritized. I mean, I was thinking the other day, I was sitting down to take a poll last night about who would be the Time Magazine's Person of the Year. And I was going through the poll and there were multiple options, of course. And the WHO is one option, along with obviously different politicians, celebrities, American officials, Kamala Harris, Trump, Biden, all this. But I was fascinated that, my guess is that I didn't find that group in the poll, is that in general, healthcare workers could actually become, frontline workers who've been part of this COVID-19 battle, to say, would probably be ranked very high, in terms of being person of the year or persons of the year. So it's interesting that the WHO is actually highlighting, them going forward in the next year.
Yeah.
Finally, sort of any other decisions, because so much of the conversation has been about COVID-19 and related to that. It's not like, and like you pointed out in the whole immunization discussion, right, that there are so many other diseases that we continue to need to immunize against, that we continue to need to tackle, which continue to claim lives. There are things like in India, you have dengue, you have malaria, you have all these things still there.
Yes.
What's the sort of, has there been any other focus on other diseases and any sort of timelines, agenda, outcomes, anything like that?
Yes. So there are many other decisions that the World Health Assembly has taken. And one of the most important decisions is relating to neglected tropical diseases. So neglected tropical diseases are like a diverse group of communicable or infectious diseases that prevail in tropical and subtropical areas. And they affect more than 1 billion people and cost developing countries billions of dollars every year. And these diseases particularly affect populations living in poverty for obvious reasons, because these populations, they live in inadequate sanitary conditions, and they are always in close contact with infectious vectors and domestic animals and livestock. So now these tropical diseases affect the populations living under poverty line the most. So in this World Health Assembly, the executive board has requested the director general to accelerate the work to overcome the global impact of neglected tropical diseases and come up with a draft roadmap for the same, which will run from 2021 to 2030. The draft roadmap, it seeks to encourage a fundamental shift in focus from disease-specific programs that may be reliant on external partners to integrated approaches based on common delivery platform centered on the needs of patients and communities in the context of universal health coverage. So this is one decision that has been taken for neglected tropical diseases. Another decision that has been taken during this assembly relates to healthy aging. So the member states have endorsed a proposal for a decade of healthy aging, 2020 to 2030, and asked the Director General to report back on progress on its implementation every 3 years during the decade. So populations around the world are aging at a faster pace than in the past. And like we say that, you know, India is youthful country, but even India will be an aging country in the next few years. So this demographic transition, it will have an impact on almost all aspects of society. And already there are more than 1 billion people aged 60 years or older, with most living in low and middle income countries. And many don't even have access to the basic resources necessary for life of respect and dignity, and many others confront face multiple barriers that prevent their full participation in society. So the decade of healthy aging can be an opportunity to bring together governments, civil societies, international agencies, and private sector for, you know, concerted and collaborative action to improve the lives of older people, their families, and communities in which they live. Next decision focuses on food safety. So a new resolution has been passed which urges member states to apply a One Health approach that promotes the sustainability and availability of safe, sufficient, and nutritious food for all populations. Recognizing food safety threats, including foodborne antimicrobial resistance and climate change. And the resolution also calls upon member states to invest in national food safety systems and innovations, and to share timely data and evidence on foodborne disease outbreaks and hazards. So these are some of the few decisions. I mean, I cannot list all of the decisions here because that will take a long time. But these are some of the few important decisions that were taken in the November round of World Health Assembly.
Fascinating. This is really, really interesting, because often when we talk about, you know, the WHO and international bodies and even public health, or at least when we've talked about it over the last year, we've talked about it with such a sharp sort of political edge to everything, that some of these more important issues and the sort of work that such bodies can do by bringing people together and sort of clarifying best practices, outlining priorities, and helping sharing of knowledge, expertise, and resources tends to get ignored in the sort of broader political debate. While that is extremely important, because you don't want to see politics impinging on people's public health to the way it has in this year, but you also want to see this sort of underscores the need for a body where you can sort of engage on a multilateral level and share expertise and skills. Sunila, thank you so much. This has been an interesting and fascinating conversation for me. I've got lots to learn, and I am sure that our listeners have also had lots to learn.
Thank you, Manoj.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.